So we're a week older than we were last week. So we're a week closer to our death. When you think of all the causes and conditions that we had to create in previous lives to have the rebirth we have now, which isn't just an ordinary human rebirth, but it's one with all the conditions to be able to practice the Dharma. So even more difficult to create the causes for. So when we think about this and how kind of miraculously it is that we have this life, and then remember that it's not going to really last for so long. And every moment that passes is one moment closer to our death. And although we think that we won't die for a very long time, all the people who died today thought that as well. So there's no certainty about when our death will come. And at the time of death, there is no choice but to die. We have no negotiating power. No doctor can save us. No lawyer can save us. No loved one can save us. And we go on to our next rebirth alone. With our karma, with our habitual mental states. And so seeing this and understanding that the time of death can be very precarious if we don't have a vast store of merit, then not sure what karma will ripen. And even if we do have a vast store of merit, it's not sure what kind of mental state we'll be in at the time of death. The only real security we have is if we have realized emptiness, if we know the ultimate nature, and so can really let go of all grasping at I and mine at the time of death. So we should really put some effort into trying to understand emptiness. Even if we can't realize it, at least to get some kind of feeling for it. So that at the time we die, at least intellectually we can say to ourselves, there's no inherently existent person that's dying. So in order to realize emptiness, we need a lot of preliminary Dharma practices, purification, creation of merit, listening to teachings. And the teachings that we're going to hear tonight have to do with the Course on Reasoning. And reasoning is a very appropriate and excellent tool to help us understand the nature of reality. So with that ultimate aim of Buddhahood in mind, so it can benefit others and ourselves most effectively, let's work on creating the causes to realize emptiness, the emptiness of inherent existence, the ultimate nature of reality, which is what will actually free us from cyclic existence. And since we don't have any time to waste in learning this, let's really put our energy into it. So we always think we have a long time to live. Yesterday there was a school shooting, Rockford. It's a town near Spokane, south of Spokane, so in our area. And kids went to school like every other day, you know, high school kids thinking, you know, have a good time at school, goof off with your friends. And one of the kids who was a student there came with a rifle and a pistol, and he shot one of his best friends and injured three other kids before the custodian actually tackled him. And so he's in jail. And I was thinking, you know, one action like that, and he changed the course of so many people's lives, you know. One kid who's probably 15, 14, 15, huh? The sophomore, so 15, you know, is dead. His family's devastated. Probably the kid who did the killing, his family is devastated. And his life is going to turn out completely different than it would have if he had not done that, which took maybe 1 minute of his, you know, the whole thing was completed in just a few minutes. But those few minutes completely changed his life and what's possible for him, as well as what's possible for the other kids and their families. So, you know, we always think that our life is planned out and things are secure and we know what's going to go on. In actual fact, everything is very iffy, and who knows what could happen in any particular moment. So it's good to keep that in mind, so that our mind is not anxious. Anxiety doesn't help with anything, but so that our mind is aware of what cyclic existence is and can keep a positive state as much as possible at all times, so that when the unexpected comes, our mind will be in a good state. And, you know, because the unexpected comes a lot. It's not necessarily, you know, getting shot or dying, but so many unexpected things happen each day. And so often we get angry when something unexpected happens because we just didn't have it in our radar. And yet, you know, we kind of need to keep everything in our radar. Yeah. In the sense that things are changing all the time. And, you know, we are not there's no self that is a controller of everything. So to have a compassionate mind, a wise mind, so that as much as possible, you know, whatever comes into our field of experience, we can greet it with wisdom and compassion without fear and anxiety. Yeah, so we may have a lot of habit with fear and anxiety, But that doesn't mean that we have to continue that habit, or that that habit is the only choice of what we have to do. There's a lot of choice, so we should start thinking of how to train our mind in different mental states so that we really have can take that choice and have that choice, and not just operate on default, like push button, you know. Unexpected happens, push button, anxiety, you know, push button, fear. No, but to really, you know, see how else we can greet those situations. Okay. So these teachings, you know, on reasoning are really helping us to learn how to think clearly. Yeah, we think that we know how to think clearly, but, you know, even doing these, you know, the 4 points with so many things, it's like, yeah, we have to really stop and think. We don't think so clearly how things relate to each other. So before we read something, you know, one person wrote in a question and said they were thinking about what are the 4 points between love and compassion. Okay, that's how the question was written. What are, you know, how are we going to compare love and compassion? Okay, so is there something that's both love and compassion? Can love and compassion occur at the same time? They're two different mental factors. Yeah, they're two different mental factors. Are they? Yeah, are they mutually inclusive or not? If they were mutually inclusive, then it would be redundant to say love and compassion. So they must be different, yeah? Which means you think there's 4 possibilities? So here we're with the first one. What's both love and compassion? He said the wish to help a hungry person.
I guess that I can imagine there's a state of mind where you're both wishing someone to be happy and not wanting to suffer. But what mm-hmm. that would, what you would name that in one word.
Can one mental, can that wish be 2 different mental factors? Are we talking about mental factors here? Love and compassion are both mental factors. They're separate mental factors. Or are we talking about mental states, where one mental state could have both love and compassion? If we're just saying love and compassion, then you have to pick one mental factor that is both love, and that same mental factor is both compassion. Is both love and compassion. Yeah, they seem like just the mental factors are mutually exclusive. So when you say, what's the same of love and compassion, you have to think about, are you, what do you mean? The mental factors or the mental states in which the mental factors of love and compassion can be in the concomitant with the primary mind? Because you can have a mental state that has, I would think, both love and compassion as mental factors in it. But the 2 mental factors are different. In the same way, we can have 1 mental state that has ignorance and love, but ignorance and love are different mental factors. But you can have 1 mental state that has more than 1 mental factor, and love and compassion are certainly not, you know, they don't seem contradictory to me. So I would think that 1 mental factor, you could have both love and compassion. I mean, 1 mental state, you could have both love and compassion in the retinue of the different mental factors. That's what I'm thinking. Yeah?
Think of it that way, then I would think you could say four possibilities, and one that would be both would be like a bodhisattva, always crying bodhisattva.
Always crying bodhisattva is a person.
Right, but a person.
A person is not a mental state, and a person is not a mental factor. When we're, see, do you see what I'm getting at? People, we think in a very sloppy way. Mm. Yeah? Okay, so first of all, are we talking about the mental factors, love and compassion, or are we talking about mental states that could have love and compassion? We have to decide. Let's decide one or the other.
What's the definition?
Remember when we studied Lohrig? There can be a primary mind, and then a primary mind has different mental factors. There's the five omniscient ones, and then there's other mental factors that color that mental state. So love and compassion are both those, you know, in the category of the other mental factors that can join in with that primary mind and its five omnipresent mental factors. A mental state is including the primary mind plus the mental factors. Do you remember when?
I remember the mental
factors. Okay, so a primary mind, yeah, when we talk about consciousness, you know, it can be, there's mind and there's mental factors. Yeah. Amongst mind, we have the five primary sense consciousnesses and the primary mental conscious. Among mental factors, there's many, many, but there's 51 that we study in particular. Okay. When you have a mental state, then you have a primary mind with certain mental factors that are concomitant or associated with it. So among those, there's five omnipresent ones. Yeah, do you remember what they are? Feeling, discrimination, intention, contact, attention. Okay, so those five come with every primary mind, whether it's a sense consciousness or a mental consciousness. Plus, there's other mental factors that can also join in. Okay? So love and compassion you find amongst the 11 virtuous mental factors. This is why it is important to remember what you studied before. Okay, so are we talking about just the mental factors, or are we talking about a mental state that consists of a primary mind plus mental factors? Which one do you want to talk about? We could talk about either one, you just have to decide. Okay, so we'll do a mental state. So is there a mental state in which you have both love and compassion? You don't think love and compassion can occur in one mental state?
No, the reason is that mental factors share the five similarities with their main mind.
Right.
And love and compassion, although they focus on the same object, they have different aspects. So if you have the aspect of wishing all sentient beings to be free of suffering, that's a different aspect. Primary mental consciousness will have that aspect too. If you're talking about love, then you're wishing for that, your object to have happiness and the causes of happiness. Mm-hmm. So I think they would have to come alternately.
You think they would go alternately very quickly?
Yeah,
between
because they have different aspects.
Love and compassion. Possible. Yeah. I wonder if anybody would say that they are not, although they're different mental factors, you know, their aspects are very, very similar, because it's hard to wish somebody to be alleviated from free of suffering if you don't always also wish them to be happy. But it is possible to have a mind that's focused more particularly on compassion and one that's focused more particularly on love. Yeah. Or it could be, like you say, that you go back and forth. Yeah?
If not, I think you would hear people talking about bodhicitta or the cause of bodhicitta being, you know, the primary cause, the substantial cause being love and compassion. But mm-hmm. they just talk about it as being compassion.
Compassion.
So I think that they're distinguishing there that the aspect is really wishing them to be free of suffering.
Yeah.
Even though it's informed by love previously mm-hmm. as one of the causes.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be an interesting thing to ask about. But certainly, yeah, I think yours has reason in it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, what she's saying, then how would it be that those multiple virtuous mental factors can all be occurring at the same time? Because they also talk about the virtuous mental factors all occurring at once. And they aren't necessarily,
they don't say all of them occur at once.
There's some positions that hold that. Some, and they aren't necessarily...
You know, they don't say all 11 occur at once. But they
some people hold that position because I've read it.
Can you cite an example of who says that? Or yeah, maybe check that.
When talking about the holding the same aspect of mm-hmm. the mental factors, could that be they just have the aspect of a suffering person in front of them that need like the recognition, like they're holding the object of a person suffering, needing food? Is that a wrong interpretation?
No, the aspect is kind of how you're relating to it. So compassion's aspect is wanting the person to be free of suffering. Love is wanting them to have happiness.
And if we were talking about the mental factors instead of the mental state, they would be mutually exclusive?
Yeah. Let's go finish with the four, okay? So if we say that there's nothing, there's no mental states that are both love and compassion, is there a mental state that is love that is not compassion? Yes, for example. So wanting someone to learn the Dharma so they can have the happiness of becoming awakened. Good. Is there something that is a mental state with compassion but does not have love? Okay, so wishing somebody with a broken leg to be free of pain. Yeah, so you can see that those are approaching a person from two different things. Is there something that's neither a mental state with love or a mental state with compassion? Wishing someone with a broken leg to have pain. Okay. So do you see how we have to be very clear what it is exactly we're comparing? Yeah, we can't just say love and compassion and then give examples of physical actions, because physical actions are not mental factors.
Thinking of these two as two mental factors, mm-hmm. I think of like, even if they were in the same, could be in the same mind, it's like salt and pepper are mutually exclusive even if you put them in the same soup. Because
yeah.
The soup is neither pepper nor salt.
Yeah.
And that mental mind would be neither.
Yeah. I mean, you can have different mental factors together. We can have the mental factor of, feeling together with the mental factor of love within one primary mind. Okay. Okay. Another question before I do that. Another question also came up. About non-existent, you know, can you compare the category of non-existent with chair? No, this is your question. You can't. Non-existent is not an existent, so you can't compare it to anything, even the category of non-existent. Okay, it's different than what I was saying, what I said to you before. Okay, even the category of non-existent does not exist. Yeah, it is selfless. But remember, everything that's selfless is not necessarily existent. No, you can't. Remember, for two things, to compare two things, they both have to be existent. So one of them cannot be the category of non-existent, because that category doesn't exist.
Right. So even if, when you compare, you can find examples, you still cannot compare.
The category has to be existent. Even if the examples, you know, you can cite a lot of examples. Does somebody have the book? Let me read you from Non-Existent. Yeah? Recall that the selfless encompasses both existence and non-existence. Thus, the Buddhists are making the point that everything we can imagine, whether real in any sense or not at all real, is free of a self. It may seem trivial to note that that non-existence are free of a self. It better disposes of the question to note that a permanent, unitary, independent self is not to be found anywhere. There is no definition of a non-existent, because a non-existent does not exist and has no qualities to be characterized. Definitions and definienda are established on the basis of their illustrations, which must be existent. Therefore, there can be no definition of the non-existent. Even so, some say, okay, so there's a different opinion. Some say that the definition of a non-existence is that which is not observed by a reliable cognizer. That sounds good for a definition of non-existent, doesn't it? Yeah. So then non-existent would exist. It has a definition. But how do you perceive it? You know, that which is not observed by a valid cognizer. But if non-existent is existent, then it should be observed by a valid cognizer, a reliable cognizer, because that's the definition of existent. So you can't say the category of non-existent is existent. Okay? According to Demalocha Rinpoche, this proposed definition incurs the fallacy of non-occurrence. A non-existent is not an existent and is not experienced as an existent. Thus, it does not occur. A non-existent would have to be established, meaning established by a reliable cognizer, with its illustrations, those things that illustrate the quality of a non-existent. However, we cannot observe by any reliable consciousness that for existence, a square circle or any other non-existent has the quality of a non-existent. So there is nothing to illustrate a non-existent. So there is no definition of a non-existent. Also, I know of no division of non-existence, and somehow I doubt there could be one. Okay? So whether you see non-existent, you know, if you see it as a category, yeah, non-existence, there's nothing, there's examples of non-existent, but there's not something that illustrates the character of a non-existent, because the characteristics of a non-existent, because non-existents don't have any characteristics, because if they did, they would exist. Okay? So therefore, you can't compare a non-existent to anything else. Yeah? Okay. So just to review the previous one, let's do a couple of things. Let's compare animals and persons. Okay, do we have two people who want to do it? Okay, one here. Somebody else? Okay. So you do it with each other, animals and persons.
How do the two compare, animals and persons?
There are three possibilities between animals and persons.
Okay. It follows that there are not three possibilities between animals and persons. Give an example of something that is both an animal and a person.
There is something, a cat.
Now, which way does the pervasion go?
An animal is necessarily a person, but it doesn't hold that a person is necessarily an animal.
Give an example of something that is an animal but not a person.
We just did that.
We just did that.
Okay.
A person that's not an animal.
Yeah.
A person that's not an animal. Okay.
Yeah.
There is something, a human being.
Give an example of something that is neither a person nor an animal.
There is something. Justice.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So do you understand that an animal is a person? Okay. When we talk, you know, persons can be any beings in the six realms. You know, a person can be a carpenter, a fireman, a teacher, you know. Hungry ghost. A deva, you know, a bodhisattva, an Arya Buddha. Okay. Yeah, okay. So this kind of thing helps you to understand, you know, what does the category person mean? It doesn't mean just human being.
So is a person the same as a sentient being, or is there any...
Okay, let's compare sentient being and person. Okay, is there something that is both a sentient being and a person? Yeah, Venerable Samten. Okay, sentient being and a person. Sentient being and a person. Is there something that's a sentient being but not a person? There aren't any. Okay, what is a person but not a sentient being? An Arya Buddha. Okay. Is just Buddha a person but not a sentient being? No. Okay. Is a Nirmanakaya a person but not a sentient being? An emanation body is a person. That's an interesting one. Is a Nirmanakaya that's a bridge a person? Sounds funny, doesn't it? Yeah. But you know, whatever is one of the four kayas is not necessarily a person. Okay, if we do the four Buddha bodies in person, how do they compare? Is there something that is one of a Buddha body plus and also a person? Yes, what? Yeah. What's an example of a Nirmanakaya? Shakyamuni Buddha. Okay, is there something that is what are we comparing? Four Buddha bodies and persons. Is there something that's one of the four Buddha bodies, but not a person? The wisdom Dharmakaya, okay, yeah. Also the nature Dharmakaya. Is there something that is one of the four Buddha a person, but not one of the four Buddha bodies. What? Yeah, a sentient being. There's something that's neither. So do you see how doing this helps you really try and think and understand what things are? Yeah, because so often we think we know things, but when we start to ask these kinds of questions, we realize that we don't really understand.
You started out this comparing humans and animals.
Uh-huh.
Technically, a human is an animal. It's just a higher order of animal.
Yeah. No, we were doing animals and persons.
And the difference would be?
Oh, that's true. Yeah. From a Buddhist system, animals and humans are different realms. So they're not the same. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a good thing to bring something like that up, because then you have to see what system are we analyzing in terms of the Buddhism or scientific categorization of, you know, things. Okay, shall we read from the book a little bit? Okay, so four possibilities. Just as in the case of three possibilities, four possibilities might be more literally translated as four corners. In this case, there are usually four things to point to in the discussion of the comparison. Also, as in the case of three possibilities, this is one of the two comparisons for which the debaters make a difference between one, the case of four possibilities for which there is something outside of the two circles, that is neither a P nor a Q, and two, the case of four possibilities for which there is nothing outside the two circles, that is neither a P nor a Q. Okay, so how are the two circles drawn in case of four possibilities? Yeah, like this. So there's some overlapping area and some distinct areas. In either of the two types of four possibilities, this is the comparison where some are and some are not in both directions. Okay, like happy people and smart people. Some happy people are smart and some are not. And some smart people are happy and some are not. In both of the cases of four possibilities, there's no pervasion between the two things being compared, not in either direction. Yeah, because you would not say if it's a happy person, it's necessarily a smart person. Okay. Whatever is a P is not necessarily a Q, and whatever is a Q is not necessarily a P. For example, it is not the case that all happy people are smart people, and it is not the case that all smart people are happy people. Some are and some aren't. Okay. The comparison of four possibilities is represented by the two circles overlapping. It is essential that there must be at least one thing that is both a P and a Q inside the overlapping two circles in that central part. Also, whether or not there is anything that is neither, there must be something that is a P but not a Q, so inside the Q circle but not inside the P circle but not inside the Q circle, and there must be something that is a Q but not a P, so inside the Q circle but outside the P circle. You can understand this. You can understand from this that it is also not the case that whatever is a P is not a Q, and it is not the case that whatever is a Q is necessarily not a P. Okay? So there can be something that is both a P and a Q. Okay? That is part of being some are and some aren't. Okay. So, answer and debate. There are four possibilities between Q and P. The classic case of four possibilities has all four points to touch on. These four, there is something that is both a P and a Q. There is something that is a P but not a Q. There is something that's a Q but not a P. And there's something that's neither of them. Here, too, the relative sizes of the circles may or may not represent the relative extensions or the sizes of the two groups that you're comparing. Okay. So, for example, this is the comparison between blue and the colors of cloth. Okay, so let's do that. What's the comparison between blue and colors of cloth? How many points? How many corners? Four. Okay. So is there something that is both blue and the color of a cloth? Yes. What? Yeah, the anagarika jacket. Okay. No, the color of the anagarika jacket. Yeah. The anagarika jacket is yeah. Okay. So what's the anagarika jacket? If we're comparing blue and the color of cloth, which one is the anagarika jacket? Yeah, the jacket itself is not either of the two. Okay. So is there something that is blue that is not the color of a cloth? Yes, for the color of the blue sky. Why don't you just say blue sky? Because that's not a color. Okay. Is there something that is the color of a cloth but not blue? Yeah. The color of our robes. Yeah. Okay. And then something that's neither blue nor the color of cloth, the anagarika jacket. The chart, when it has on the second line for the color of the blue sky, there should be an X under the colors of cloth instead of a checkpoint, a check. So the chart shows that the color of a blue cotton shirt is both blue and the color of cloth. That the color of a blue sky is blue, but it's not the color of a cloth. That the color of a white shirt is the color of a cloth, but not blue. And that the color of a ruby is neither blue nor the color of a cloth. In this case, there are examples in all four possibilities. Okay, so let's do the first one here. Money and things of value, how do they compare? Do we have two people?
How do the two compare, Venerable Tarpa? Money and things of value.
There are four possibilities between money and things of value.
It follows that there are not four possibilities between money and things of value. Give an example of something that is both money and a thing of value.
There is something, the subject, $100 bill.
Give an example, something that is a thing of value but not money.
There is something, our Buddha statue.
Give an example of something that is a thing of value but not money.
No, we did that one.
We just did that. Something that's
that is a thing
money,
of,
but not a thing of value.
No, we
but
did
money.
That one.
No, we didn't do that one yet. Money, but not a
okay. Money, but not a king of value.
Money,
no
but
thing
not
of value.
A thing of value.
What's that unit of money in India? That really
a rupee.
Really small, even smaller than
pesa.
That. Pesa, a pesa.
Yeah.
It's money, but not a thing of value.
Yeah.
Give an example of something that is neither money nor a thing of value.
A crayon.
A crayon, okay. Now, to a child, a crayon might be a thing of value. Yeah, so you also have to, you know, specify a value to whom. Yeah. Not just thing of value, because we don't all agree on what a thing of value is. Okay. How about, let's do 4 points between, no, we did this last week, but I think it's good to review, between empty and existent. Empty and existent. Is there some, yeah? So how do they compare?
It follows that there are three possibilities between empty and existent.
It follows that there are not three possibilities between empty and existent. Give an example of something that is both empty and existent.
My laptop.
Now, which way does the provision go?
It follows that whatever is an existent is necessarily empty, but what is empty is not necessarily an existent.
Mm-hmm. So give an example of something that is existent but not empty.
There is nothing that is existent but not empty.
and then yeah, so give an example of something that is neither empty nor nor existent.
There is nothing that is
There's an example of something that is neither empty nor existent.
There is nothing that is neither
is
empty
neither
nor existent.
Empty nor existent.
So it's three possibilities existent. With nothing that is neither.
Wait a minute. So there's something that was both mm-hmm. empty and existent is
a laptop.
Yes. Okay. Something that is empty but not existent.
The horns are a rabbit.
Rabbit's horn. Okay. Something that is existent but not empty.
Nothing.
Something that is neither existent nor empty.
Nothing.
Then emptiness and existent. Okay. Somebody would like to do those. Emptiness and existent.
How do the two, emptiness and existent, compare?
There are three possibilities between emptiness and existent.
It follows that there are not three possibilities between emptiness and existent. Give an example of something that is both emptiness and existent.
The emptiness of the laptop.
Okay, that's fine.
Now, which way does the pervasion go?
Everything that is emptiness is necessarily inexistent. Mm-hmm. Everything, but it's not the case that everything that is existent is necessarily emptiness.
Give an example of something that is emptiness but not inexistent.
There is nothing that is emptiness but not inexistent.
Give an example of something that is neither emptiness nor inexistent.
Do the
pervasion. Oh, the opposite. Give an example of something that is an existent but not emptiness.
The laptop is an example of something that is an existent but not emptiness.
Okay.
Give an example of something that is neither emptiness nor an existent.
The horns of a rabbit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Three. Okay, what about the two truths?
How do the two compare? Conventional truth, veiled truth, and ultimate truth.
Mutually exclusive.
So it follows that they are not mutually exclusive between veiled truth and conventional truth. Veiled truth and ultimate truth. Giving an example of something that is both a veiled truth and an ultimate truth.
There's nothing that is both an ultimate truth and a conventional truth.
Give an example of something that is a veiled truth but not an ultimate truth.
There is something, the subject, a cup.
Give an example of something that is an ultimate truth but not a veiled truth.
There is something, the subject, the emptiness of the cup.
Give an example of something that is neither a veiled truth nor an ultimate truth.
A sky flower. There is something, the subject is sky flower.
Oh, yeah, okay. So three, yeah.
So there's definitely nothing that's both, is that correct?
Yeah, if they're mutually exclusive, there's nothing that's both.
So the answer that they were mutually exclusive is correct, is what I'm asking.
That there are, yeah. Mutual exclusive is right, but that doesn't mean that there's no points. There's of the four corners, it doesn't mean there's no corners.
No, but
it means that there's nothing that's both of them.
But once you answer the first question, then you already know which it is.
Yeah.
If you answer no to the first question.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought that emptiness exists only conventionally.
It does exist only conventionally. Then let's do, what are the four between conventional truth and conventionally existent? Because I think that's what you're getting down to, isn't it? You're thinking emptiness exists conventionally, so why isn't it a conventional truth? Is that what you're thinking?
Yes.
Okay. So then you're thinking that everything that exists conventionally must be a conventional truth. You think there's a pervasion like that. So let's compare conventionally existent and conventional truth. Okay. Is there something that is both conventionally existent and a conventional truth?
Yes.
Yes. What?
The water bowl.
Okay. Water bowl. Is there something that is conventionally existent but not a conventional truth?
Emptiness.
Emptiness. Is there something that is a conventional truth but not conventionally existent?
No.
No. Is there something that is neither conventionally existent nor a conventional truth?
Yes. Ultimate truth?
No, because ultimate truth is conventionally existent.
A non-existent.
Non-existent, yeah. Yeah, an ultimate truth exists conventionally, but it is not a conventional truth because it's an ultimate truth. Okay, I'll give you something. You can figure out what it is. How about good drivers and someone with a driver's license? How many points are there between them? Four. Okay, two people do the.
How do the two compare? Good drivers and someone with a driver's license.
There are four possibilities between... good drivers and drivers with licenses.
It follows that there are not four possibilities between good drivers and a driver, good drivers and someone with a driver's license. Give an example of both.
Good drivers and drivers with licenses.
Now give an example of a person.
Of a person who has a driver's license and a good driver. There is somebody. Venerable Tarpa.
Give an example of someone who is who has a driver's license but is not a good driver.
There is somebody, a driver under the influence of alcohol.
Well, that's a good one. Yeah.
Give an example of someone that is neither a good driver nor.
Have to do somebody.
Sorry.
Somebody who's a good driver but doesn't have a driver's license.
Okay. Give an example of someone who is a good driver and who does not have a driver's license.
There is somebody.
Oh, no,
Ryan.
Give an example of someone who is neither a good driver nor do they have a driver's license.
There is somebody, Venerable Jordan.
What? No, I have a driver's license.
No. Yeah.
I have a license.
You have a driver's license? Okay.
Try my tree. Or try. Yeah, a child.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, a specific good, child.
A good would be a good.
No,
would be neither.
Neither.
Good, yes, a small, a 6-year-old child.
Yeah.
In the debate process, is there a place where you figure out agreeing on a definition?
Yeah, so, you have to agree on definitions.
So do you start a debate like that?
Yeah, you can't do a debate if you don't have common definitions.
So we were talking about this yesterday. Hate speech and freedom of speech.
Not freedom. Freedom of speech, I think you could say, because hate speech is words. Freedom of speech isn't words. It's... how can we phrase it so that we're comparing it? Yeah, a type of speech. So free speech, maybe. Yeah. Free speech and hate speech. Yeah, so free speech, it would be something that accords with the First Amendment, if we agree on that. I'll ask the Supreme Court. But I'm not saying that they know. We can figure that. But, you know, this will actually bring it out if we start to debate it.
How do the two compare, free speech and hate speech?
So I think there's four possibilities. Mm-hmm.
It follows that there are not four possibilities. Give an example of something that is both free speech and hate speech.
Claiming that President Obama is not an American.
Okay. Are we accepting that definition? Would that fall under the hate speech? Not sure.
Would people consider
calling President Obama a monkey. Okay. Is that hateful enough?
Yeah.
I think that maybe some sort of like anti-Semite comment or very racist comment would be hate speech, but
it was very difficult to find the definition of free speech. Mm-hmm. Hate speech is a communication that carries no meaning other than the expression of hatred for some group, especially in circumstances in which the communication is likely to provoke violence. It is an incitement to hatred primarily against a group of persons defined in terms of race, ethnicity, national origin, gender, religion, sexual orientation, and the like. Hate speech can be any form of expression regarded as offensive to racial, ethnic, and religious groups and other discrete minorities or to women.
Okay, so what is an example of both? We're still on that.
Okay, so God hates homosexuals would be an example of both. Technically, that's free speech, but it's also hate speech.
Because hate speech is laws, that's not protected under free speech. You can't say that.
What? Say that again?
The hate speech laws, they take that phrase out of the lexicon of free speech. Like, you can't say that and be saying something that you're protected under freedom of speech.
Okay. So you're saying there's nothing
right
that is legally hate speech and free speech.
Hateful speech, maybe, but not hate speech. You can have hateful speech, but not hate speech.
So are we in the realm of mutually exclusive then? So then there's only three options.
Well, let's go through the other options.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Seems like.
So there's.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing.
That is okay. Both. Give an example of something that is free speech but not hate speech.
Something that is free speech would be yelling, "I love flowers."
Okay. Give an example of something that is hate speech but not free speech.
Hate speech would be, "God wants to kill," enter whatever group you want to enter.
What's something that is neither hate speech nor free speech?
A cloud.
Yeah. Okay. So it's interesting if we say hate speech and free speech are contradictory. Yeah. Then we're, like what you were saying, calling President Obama a monkey, which one does that fall under? Hate speech, but not free speech. Okay. What about, what the Nazis say or what the white supremacists say? Hate speech, but not free speech. But they're claiming it's free speech. So on what basis do they say it's free speech? And they're saying it's free speech, but not hate speech. So on what basis are they saying that? How are they defining the two? That they're saying it's free speech, but not hate speech.
I would think that they would have to say that it's, if you went by their opinion, you'd have to say that it's, that they're not mutually exclusive and that the hate speech laws are infringing upon their freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. That's what they've been claiming.
Yeah.
And especially people that are saying exactly things like God hates homosexuals. They're like, we can't even say what we want in our own churches, or mm-hmm. we'll go to jail, which of course they are saying these things in their churches, and they're not going to jail. but they, yeah. you wouldn't, they wouldn't be mutually exclusive then. So that's really a crux of it, mm-hmm. of whether or not there are two things that could be defined either way.
Yeah, well, that's why you have to define, yeah, what you're, the two things.
So we didn't really define free speech then.
Well,
because free speech, if you looked at it as defined by the First Amendment, mm-hmm. then that's where you come up with, can person say this? Because the First Amendment was based on, I don't have to agree with what you say, but I agree with your right to say it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've decided that that's detrimental to society.
Yeah.
You had given the example last time about that church, Westboro Baptist Church, and
right.
how, I guess it went to the Supreme Court, or maybe it was just a lower court, but it was decided legally that them screaming, child deserved to die because of homosexuality. I mean,
the child wasn't even, that soldier wasn't even gay. It's yeah. just that, you know, there's gays in America, so therefore, their reasoning is there's gays in America, so therefore, of course, your child who's in the military died.
So many would consider that hate
it's
speech.
It's a strange syllogism.
I wonder what the legal rationale was behind saying that's not hate speech. Maybe because it's not personal to the person who died. And we can go either way. I mean,
why wouldn't they call it the hate speech? Maybe because they'd say it's not inciting people to violence.
I thought the case was about where they can scream that.
Yeah.
That was more about where they can scream their stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Or protests.
Yeah. But it is that, but it had to do something with free speech. I mean, are there two categories of free speech? One, you can say near the person that you're insulting, near the person you want to hurt, and another that you have to step back from them before you say it.
So yeah. According to this one website, says which types of speech are not protected by the First Amendment. Although different scholars view unprotected speech in different ways, there are basically 9 categories. Obscenity is not protected by the First Amendment. Fighting words. Defamation.
Fighting words. Okay.
Defamation, including libel and slander. Mm-hmm. Child pornography. Perjury, blackmail, incitement to imminent lawless action, true threats, and solicitations to commit crimes are not protected by the First Amendment.
Okay, so they're saying that the Americans are being punished because there's gays in America. Does it fall under any of those categories?
Fighting words, defamation.
I think it would be defamation if they were talking about the soldier at the soldier's funeral, but their picket protest is so scattered, like it's not just about the soldier. It's very widespread, so they're not just defaming, although they are at the same time. This is a tricky.
Yeah, they are offending people.
Yeah.
Aren't they slandering a whole class of people?
But their claim is not slanderous by nature. It is very terrible, but slander is sending a spoken wrong truth about a specific person.
Yeah.
And it's an opinion that gays are going to go to hell. It's not an untruth.
Depends who's thinking it. Yeah. Yeah. Are you in law school?
Seems like it's slander against homosexuals, not necessarily the soldiers whose funeral they're at, but a whole class of people.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what they're all saying.
Yeah, but he's saying it's an opinion, And you're saying slander has to be a wrong truth, a lie. So we consider what they're saying to be a lie. They consider it to be a truth. Yeah. So just even conventionally. So we should be able, I mean, still it doesn't make much logic, much sense, you know. Even if somebody believes, you know, that homosexuality is a sin or whatever, why is that a connection between, you know, therefore American soldiers deserve to die? Yeah, that doesn't hold water. Anyway, okay, should we do some more here?
Yeah. This is something that you didn't debate with Jeffrey about.
Uh-huh.
Well, how about would be thought and non-conceptual thought?
See, to me, all thought needs to be conceptual thought. Yeah. I could say some of what they call conceptuality doesn't need to be thought. Yeah, because they often say that the white and red appearance are conceptual consciousnesses, but they're not thought, as we define thought. But to me, when I think of thought, it would have, you know, I think it would have to be conceptual. Jeffrey said no, because he was translating the word thought as intention. Yeah, we often translated it as the intention, and he was thinking of it as thought, meaning the intention or the purpose of the Buddha. And I was saying thought is, I would have a narrower definition of the word thought. Four possibilities without anything that is neither. Why don't we do that? Okay. There are four possibilities between P and Q without anything that is neither. So some pairs of phenomena compare in a similar way to the classic example of four possibilities, but for them there is nothing you can posit as anything that is neither. As in the case of three possibilities without the possibility of something that is neither, in Buddhist reasoning and debate, this is marked as a separate case. So here are the three points. There is something that is both a P and a Q. There is something that is a P but not a Q. And there is something that is a Q but not a P. In this case, there is nothing one can point to which is neither a P nor a Q. As in the normal cases of four possibilities, we can say some are and some aren't. But it's still three possibilities, not four. Comparisons of this type necessarily involve two phenomena that together include all existence and non-existence as well. An example of this type of comparison is the comparison of existence, P, and non-permanent phenomena, Q. Okay? Which includes all existence other than impermanent phenomena, as well as all non-existence. So non-impermanent phenomena means everything that is not a permanent phenomena. If you had it with the parentheses before non-impermanent and then phenomena, then that would refer to permanent phenomena. Okay, so that's why the parentheses are there. So non-impermanent phenomena refer to everything that's not an impermanent phenomena, which includes non-existence. Okay, so explaining the chart, something that's both an existent and a non-impermanent phenomena. Okay, for example, a permanent phenomena, okay? Something that is inexistent but not a non-impermanent phenomena. A pot. Okay, a pot exists. A pot is also, it's not non-permanent phenomena. Yeah, okay. And then, okay, something that is, there's something that's a non-impermanent phenomena, but not an existent. Okay, a fourth possibility. I can't help it. Well, I can. Yeah. A fourth possibility, something that is neither, is inconceivable. Something which, on the one hand, is not an existent, and on the other, is a non-impermanent phenomena, that is, an impermanent phenomena, cannot be posited. Okay? Because a non-impermanent phenomena is an impermanent phenomena. As indicated by the use of the horn of a rabbit as the subject in the third point above, it is not necessary that the individual possibilities be existents. It is only necessary that there be a subject that exemplifies the two qualities of the individual point. So in line with this sense of a possibility, something that is not an existent but is an impermanent phenomena is not possible. So let's save the exercise for next week, because that will help us review what we just read. Okay?